Welcome to Creative Instinct on RN, RA and the web. I'm Michael Sheriffs. And today, how important is art in times of genocide? Rahm Emanuel, who's worked in country after country and across all continents, has seen that art reappears, phoenix-like, after the worst atrocities and inhumanity, whenever societies are stifled with injustice and crushed by physical and cultural violence, remarkably, the human spirit of creativity refuses to die. This program is a tribute to art in all its myriad forms, however and wherever it can exist, openly or furtively, loudly with collective voices and stomping feet as in South Africa's anti-apartheid music, or unobtrusively as in the poetic ballads of the Somalis. Sometimes it's both surreptitious and brazen, like the graffiti on the walls of Palestine or East Timor or Kosovo, where inhabitants are trapped within battlefields.
Art offers an opening for the heart. True art makes the divine silence in the soul burst into applause.
These are the words of the great Sufi master Hafiz of Shiraz.
I have come into the world to see this. Men drop their weapons, even at the arc of their rage, because they have at last realised there is but one flesh to wound.
Hafiz is one of Rahm Emanuel's most beloved poets. Rahm is a senior research fellow with the University of Oxford and a member of the World Future Council. It means that she spends a lot of time in a tough political climate, one that doesn't have a lot of room for art. But art, she says, does have a role to play in the prevention of genocide. During a recent visit to Australia, Rahm Emanuel tells me about her revelation, and we're sitting under an oak tree in Melbourne's Botanical Gardens.
Hi, I'm Rahm Emanuel. I live in France. I'm of Indian origin. I grew up in Bombay. And my passion since I was a child is really justice and peace. And that's what I've done most of my life. But over the last 12 years, my passion has evolved to become finding ways in which art, culture and spirituality might be the path to lead us towards peace and justice.
You've been particularly focused in this time here on the mechanisms of genocide. And genocide is normally something that's framed within ideas of politics, of power, of violence. But you see art and culture as having an incredibly important role. You've sort of realised that that's almost a missing link. Just tell me the mechanism of how art and culture feeds into our understanding of genocide.
Absolutely. I was on a mission. I was then responsible for policy to do with conflict, the reduction of conflict in Africa. And I was a hard-nosed political scientist at that point and believed that it was through campaigning and policy work and working with, you know, the decision makers that we could cajole or convince or coerce people to change their ways and become peaceful. And honestly, I would actually say that the revelation came before my observation. So it was kind of, I was almost made to look that way. It was the middle of the night. I had that day met a few artists who had, in a sense, stumbled as well upon this discovery. And in the middle of the night, it just came to me that the way in which we can end or prevent mass violence, the desire to do violence, is through that which touches the heart and soul, even the hardest heart. And that is, I don't mean art with a capital A, as in the high art we find in museums and concerts. That is important. But I mean any form of creative expression at all the levels, and all the levels can feed into each other. And after that revelation, it began to be that that is what I indeed saw confirmed in country after country. And sometimes it would take, you know, you would see that a particular form of art was the major thing, like, you know, Southern Africa, the anti-apartheid music and poetry. But sometimes you'd find a whole jumble of different kinds of expressions emerging, which seem to demonstrate this.
So Tell me what the steps are of cultural eradication, of the sort of ethnocide that we have so often missed, in a sense, as a sort of, I suppose, an early warning system. Are there sort of predictable and patterned steps of behaviour from people in power?
What we seem to notice is, well, I'll start off with the conclusion that came out in the project I just did looking at culture and genocide. From Rwanda, where so many studies have looked at the economic and political and race and other aspects, our scholar looked at how culture, in fact, in all our societies, is a bulwark which provides for the coexistence, because it gives you a basis to see that we are in common. What we have in common as brothers or sisters is greater than what we have which separates or divides us. So the way in which politicians work to undermine this edifice of culture which brings us together is to start creating a sense of otherness. So little by little, if you just take the example of Rwanda, the original myth, the cultural myth of origin, is that God, their God, created three brothers who were practically twins. And there was a test to see who was fit for leadership. And it was, furthermore, the myth says that he who rules gives up his kind of tribal belonging, so to speak. So to be a ruler, and this, if we look at all our cultures, is very similar. You no longer represent your group, your tribe, your ethnicity, your religion. You're above, you have transcended it, so you can serve the needs of all of society, regardless who. Instead, during this period of cultural manipulation, divisive myths of saying the superiority of the ruler, which suppressed the other classes, which started creating a sense of separateness, of pointing out the differences. Thereafter, there's a process, once you create a sense of differences, of pointing out how the oppressive class oppressed you, or how the dominated class deserves to be dominated because it is dirty, inferior, threatening, etc. You start creating little stereotypes of why that particular group is a danger to you. And then you start creating a feeling that if you do not, it actually poses an existential threat to your survival, not just you and your immediate descendants, but posterity, that you will be wiped out the face of the earth if you don't destroy them first. And I have to come back to my country of origin, and probably the reason I became so passionate about justice, because I belong to the, well, I grew up as the religion that's the majority of the country, which is Hindus. But still, over time, despite our profound philosophy, which isn't simply the equality of religions, it is the fundamental equality that me and this oak leaf of this oak tree we are sitting under are one. I am one with every bit of dust. I am one with every mouse and with every elephant and with every being, however evolved or however basic, you know, with an amoeba. That it goes to that level, and still Hindus have managed to convince themselves in the height of their bigotry or their dogma that they need to go out there and massacre the 100+ million Muslims, because if they don't, the Muslims will exterminate them and we will die out as a species. Whereas our sacred scriptures, which they are unaware of, say as long as one ant survives on earth, you are still alive, because our bodies are nothing, you know. And I think it's this, that you create the sense of otherness regardless what your basic founding cultural philosophy, your universal spiritual philosophy, which gives you a sense of oneness with every living being and with nature, and you instead begin to believe that the person next to you, who you loved till yesterday, is a threat to your survival for the rest of time.
When I entered the street, I just saw dozens of bodies laying down the street, and everything was covered in blood.
After the humiliation of the fall of several other safe havens, the international community was also supposed to be better prepared. UN
the stench of death is everywhere in Kigali, the capital of Rwanda, as the bloodletting that's already claimed 20,000 lives continues. Despite attempts by the United Nations to broker a truce
returned from Kampuchea, describes the country's 4 years under the Khmer Rouge as a human catastrophe without measure.
In Bosnia Herzegovina, our morning call came from the barrel of a gun. Many guns on both sides. This is a mainly Serbian enclave, and it seems that the
country is still in deep crisis. It'll be at least 1 month before the new government takes power. Enough time, say aid workers, for the rebels who formed a government to continue the systematic murder of the Hutus.
Indeed, the fighting has been before. There is no mediation. There are no peace talks. Only Serbs and Muslims battling it out.
The extraordinary thing about Rahm Emanuel's message is that it's so hard for political minds to hear what she's saying.
And they were mistaken, and will always be mistaken, who prophesy that art will disintegrate, that it will outlive its forms and die. It is we who shall die. Art will remain. And shall we comprehend, even on the day of our destruction, all its facets and all its possibilities?
This is a quote from Russian writer Alexander Solzhenitsyn, and it's from his Nobel Prize acceptance speech in 1970. And as if to prove how hard it is for political minds to take creativity seriously, here's the former Australian Foreign Minister Gareth Evans at Rahm Emanuel's recent book launch.
This stuff, which has been so often dismissed as a bit wanky in the past, the cultural dimension, the religious dimension, the intersection point between that and the realpolitik, the high state politics in the Security Council, is that the players in the Security Council have recognised the need for a bit of sensitivity training in terms of what's happening on the ground, because they can't just direct the shape and outcomes by sending in the Marines or sending in X number of civilian administrators or rule of law experts and so on. They've got to be responsive to the dynamics on the ground if they are going to actually change things and ensure you don't plunge back into a recurrence of exactly the same problems you've had before. And really, I've noticed, because I've been in and out of New York and these places for a long time now, and I've noticed over time, sometimes it depends on the personalities that are concerned, but the kind of debate that you and others have been generating about this is a very much a current that is coming into that larger thinking, and that's very, very salutary and very important development, I think.
The book launch at the University of Melbourne was for a collection co-edited by Rahm Emanuel called Responsibility to Protect, Cultural Perspectives in the Global South. And the chapter Rama wrote herself was, of course, about art.
The phenomenon that I discovered as a peace builder working in a range of countries across all the continents, during the worst period of atrocities and after, there was a kind of burgeoning of art, which was not simply a digression or a way to get rid of your stress, but actually this art was there to inform us. And if we, politicians and policymakers, do not look at it to see what is it trying to tell us that people cannot tell us, those walls in Palestine or East Timor, the graffiti on them, or in front of the UN mission, is sending us a message. The kinds of songs or theatre that's being performed can actually help us to better know what we can do to support this population and what we are not doing right. So both are acts of commission and omission. And we can actually work with them without co-opting them. And it brings out to the fore the need for creativity in all aspects of international relations and policy making. We looked at Rwanda, where the key message of our very senior scholar who actually works on literature, myths, and theatre was that every genocide is preceded by cultural ethnocide. So if we in the prevention business can actually begin to see the signs, you know, we know how tyrants behave, but if we can begin to see how they are instrumentalizing culture and slowly beginning to erode culture to create the ground for genocide, we might already have an additional tool to work with.
Politicians these days think in terms of economics, trade, defense. They dismiss art and culture as being sort of soft, as not being a major part of international diplomacy. Why? Because you say that in the past, rulers were often, if not philosophers, they had philosophers talking in their ear. They kept philosophers close as warnings, as wisdom. So why have we moved to a state where that doesn't happen.
I think that as long as we have a society where the accumulation of power, both economic and political, is the paradigm, which it continues to be for the major powers. You don't all have, you know, little kingdoms like Bhutan, which believes that foremost we need a culture of happiness and we should be quantifying gross national happiness and not gross national wealth, or at least spiritual and you know, cultural wealth and not economic wealth. Since we don't have that, we no longer have the kinds of rulers or regimes which recognize that we need to invest in well-being and harmonious coexistence, which requires philosophers, thinkers, visionaries, artists of all kinds. And that's unfortunately not a priority. What is it that brought that about? It's a culture of domination. And I feel now that while it's at its height, I think it's being slowly sapped. I mean, I think we've reached a saturation point where people are beginning to realize that economic and political power doesn't provide any kind of security. And I work a great deal in the field of global security, and I look at, you know, the underbelly of terrorism and things like that. And I think there's a recognition that something is drastically wrong with all our buffering, and something basic, which is a well-being of inner security, inner peace, is lacking. So maybe the tides will turn.
You're listening to Creative Instinct on RN, RA and the web. I'm Michael Sheriffs. And today we're speaking about art in times of genocide and the astonishing life-affirming quality of art and creation that survives even the worst of horrors. One story that's become emblematic of this in recent times is that of Vedran Shmailovic, who came to be known as the cellist of Sarajevo because of his defiant daily performances of Albinoni's Adagio in the streets during the siege of Sarajevo. But the cellist wasn't the only one whose art experienced a revival during the war. In her research, Ramamani came across this parallel story in Kosovo. This was the time when Milosevic had occupied Kosovo by force, and the entire Kosovo-Albanian population mobilised in protest and organised a parallel system of education, healthcare, transport and government. A remarkable clandestine movement.
Before the war, everything closed down. All theatres were forbidden. Albanian artists organised theatre in religious houses, mosques, churches, anywhere they could. The National Theatre of Kosovo organised a performance of Beckett's Waiting for Godot very secretly. It was very dangerous to attend during the occupation, yet it attracted a full house. The hall was bursting. The irony is that the same play had been staged 10 years earlier, but almost no one came. Yet now it was so symbolic. Waiting for what? Nobody knows. We are in limbo. People can read the same text in very different ways in war as compared to in peace.
Gogo enters and watches for a long while before speaking.
Nothing to be done.
I'm beginning to come round to that opinion. Let's go.
We can't.
Why not?
We're waiting for Godot.
Oh. Are you sure it was here by the tree? By this tree?
Are there others?
Given that most governments treat artists, writers, as being sort of filigree on the edge of society, they're not main players. We don't have strong cultural policies in many countries. Why is it that rulers who seek great power and great dominance, despots, fear artists and writers so much? What is it that artists and writers do that needs to be silenced?
I see a fundamental difference between what art has become in our westernized, modern, you know, globalized societies, where it's become a commodity. It's become part of just what you were talking about earlier, you know, the politics of power. So being a celebrity icon artist in the West, you can sell, you know, literally anything, your morning, whatever, mouthwash, for several million dollars. What I see happening is in situations of violence or injustice, in societies that are torn apart by real crises and suffering, the kind of appearance of creative expressions in art is of a completely different nature. It's not individualist. The artist who may or may not have been an artist, so it could be a Wole Soyinka, it could be a Mahmoud Darwish, who was kind of the Palestinian poet laureate, but this person is articulating. It's no longer his or her pen, voice, paintbrush. He or she is articulating the voices of the people. It is the cry of that whole society against oppression, against injustice, against violence. And that is what makes that person a threat. And the reason why, for example, in Algeria, every poet or artist was targeted and exterminated was because each time you snuff out one poet, you are snuffing out a whole population, because you're snuffing out that expression of what they care for. And that is why they are targeted. And that's why I deeply believe that, you know, we do to some extent as an international community protect the people, the VIPs during conflicts. We need to begin to see that these people who are expressing on behalf of their population, this is part of our human heritage. The fact that this survives, and we need to protect that because we are protecting that whole culture and speaking for that civic sense, that sense of humanity that persists. That's what it is.
So it makes me think that our antennas should be really tuned to the expressions that crop up in the unexpected places. So instead of being sort of passive consumers of art, we have to be much more active in our engagement with art, because it relies on us to recognise that.
You're so right. You seem to keep thinking ahead of me of exactly what I would have wanted to say. Yes, because I think we need to stop consuming art, being observers, you know, dispassionate. Oh, isn't that pretty or isn't that ugly? But we need to become engaged as participants and co-creators in the art. And that's part of the kind of art that emerges within these situations. I think it's characteristic of Southern art in general, where as in, you know, Australia before, and with indigenous communities everywhere, art was a part of life. You didn't separate it from life, you know. Even if you had a little bullock cart, you know, your little bull that you strip a little piece of wood and you take that with your fruits and vegetables to sell in the market, the cart was beautifully painted. It was a piece of art, you know. And we've separated ourselves from that, and we now need to make it back a part of our lives. And the art that does that, the creative expressions that make us realize that we are co-creators, you know, there's the current physicist David Bohm, who says we need creativity not just in the science and arts, but in the whole of life. All of us, and that's probably the message I would add, sorry, I'm glad I came back to that, for the United Nations and all and governments, if we do not bring in our only human faculty, which makes it worth us being human, which is our creativity, into the way in which we deal with crises. And I've seen the way over the last 20 years, the stultifying repetitions and stagnations of our minds, of repeating the same patterns, instead of completely opening our creativity and thinking of new ways of resolving crises. That's where we need it, and that's what we need to go forward towards, a more peaceful, cooperative, and fun, co-creative, joyful world, which is not, you know, into the paradigm of domination and destruction.
Rahma Mani speaking to me there under a beautiful oak tree about art and its power to warn us of impending genocide and human suffering. And you can find details of Rahma and her book called Responsibility to Protect: Cultural Perspectives in the Global South on our website. Just go to abc.net.au/Radio National and follow the links to Creative Instinct. Many thanks to John Jacobs for his sonic skills this week, and to Alice Garner and Richard Buckham for readings. I'm Michael Sheriffs, and this music is from the film A Mandla, and it was recorded in the Pretoria Central Prison in South Africa.